It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The state health department is warning Wisconsinites of significant increases in whooping cough cases this year. As of November 22nd, Wisconsin has nearly 1,900 confirmed cases statewide. Whooping cough, also known as pertussis, is a serious respiratory illness. It can result in complications like pneumonia, even death, especially in young children and infants. Kids and teens between the ages of 11 and 18 make up half of this year's cases so far in Wisconsin. For a closer look at the latest spike in cases, we have Dr. Jim Conway, professor of pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also medical director for UW Health Immunization Programs. Kate Archer-Kent talked to Dr. Conway earlier this week.
What is the latest information on the spike in pertussis, known as whooping cough, the cases you're seeing in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we continue to see spread throughout the state. Over 65 counties throughout the state have reported at least one case. Majority of these are in teenagers and adolescents, and we're approaching about 2,000 cases already this year. Haven't seen any deaths in Wisconsin yet, but we are seeing infants, which is the group we really worry most about, starting to be affected, and almost a dozen have been hospitalized already.
Okay. How do the current level of cases you're seeing at this point of the season compare to the previous years and during the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, this is a lot more than we've seen now for years. We periodically, every 5 to 10 years, see these resurgences of the disease, but this is pretty significant and a lot more than we've had now for many years.
Who is most at risk of contracting this infection?
Well, anybody can contract it. You know, it's interesting. I think everybody's gotten so used to thinking about viral pathogens, whether it's COVID or flu or RSV or measles. And this is different in that it's a bacteria that creates toxins. And so really anybody can get infected or get colonized with it. The people we worry most about having severe disease are the youngest kids. The little babies are the ones that really show up with the worst symptoms. But really anybody of any age can contract this. And when older people get it, although they don't get super sick, it's still extraordinarily annoying. I mean, the ancient Chinese literature called it the 100-day cough. Mm. And so anybody who gets this gets enough airway damage that they're going to have to live with it and takes a long but gradual recovery to really get through the symptoms.
There is the cough. Can you describe the symptoms of this infection?
Yeah, I mean, for most people, it starts out initially like any other viral thing, with a runny nose, a little bit of fever, and a slight cough. And then the cough gradually gets worse over the first couple of weeks. And like I said, can last up to several months. In the youngest kids, they get enough damage into their airways. They get swelling of the airway. And they have this staccato cough. So this really very short, like, cough. And the problem is as they keep pushing air out, they start to get to the point where they're almost suffocating. And then they take this enormous big breath in, which is where they get this high-pitched whoop, which is where it gets the name, as they sort of suck air in then through this narrowed and damaged airway.
Are physicians testing more for whooping cough? More, are they doing that more often now?
Well, we're trying to get the word out. I mean, Wisconsin has really spread the word widely across all the public health systems and through all the hospital systems to try to encourage people to do more testing. But, you know, for all the cases that we've already documented, we generally think that that's probably the tip of the iceberg at some level, that there's probably a lot of people out there who, you know, think they had some kind of respiratory illness. We all have friends or family that complain that they've had this sort of lingering cough afterwards. And while, you know, for a while people would attribute that to COVID, we suspect now that at least more recently, many of those might have actually been pertussis.
Dr. Conway, how does this resolve?
Well, unfortunately, once you've gotten to the point where you've gotten the cough, it's really just a matter of giving it time for your airways to heal. We do give antibiotics to people that are exposed or early in the infection, but those are really designed to keep them from transmitting it to other people. So the antibiotics at best kind of beat it down enough that you're not carrying as much and you're not quite as likely to spread it. But unfortunately, the antibiotics don't do a lot to change the course of the illness for the person taking them. So while we ask people to do it, it's really sort of for the betterment of the public more than it is for a benefit for themselves. I mean, if you start them really early, or if you start after you've been exposed, they may protect you or prevent you from getting a full-blown case. And so when cases are identified, we do encourage not only the person who gets diagnosed with getting antibiotics, but we actually encourage everybody that's in close contact, usually the people in the household, to also get a course of antibiotics to see if we can prevent them from getting the full-blown illness.
You mentioned cases growing in teens and adolescents. Are Wisconsin schools attempting to prevent the spread among students? What do you see out there?
Yeah, so, you know, if you think about how we work our vaccines, little kids get the DTaP vaccine that gives them their primary immunity. And then we have the Tdap vaccine that was developed back in 2005, 2006. And that's given to students usually as they're entering middle school with the goal of giving them a boost of their immunity. And it's actually a school entry required vaccine. And so it's in that group of vaccines that kids get as they go into middle school. And so schools are trying to do as much as they can to ensure that people are up to date. But as we all know, there are, you know, growing numbers of people that are sometimes choosing not to get all those vaccines. But schools really are a good entry point, both for elementary school for kids with their DTaP vaccines, and then middle schools screening to see who's gotten their Tdap vaccines, to encourage people and to remind them, if they haven't gotten it yet, that it's a really good idea, especially this year, to make sure that they're up to date.
You know, for babies and younger children, it's a 5-dose series. Is that an issue at all, as it requires more regular visits to the pediatrician?
Yeah, I mean, those first couple of years of life, especially that first year of life, you know, there's a lot of different diseases that we believe are worth preventing. And so there are a lot of different vaccines that are given. You know, more and more we're seeing those vaccines be bundled together as combination vaccines to cut down the number of shots. And so that's very helpful. But, you know, it is a lot, we know, for families and for kids to get in for that number of visits. But it is really important to not only get your primary series, but then keep reminding your immune system with those boosters to maintain that immunity. You know, you mentioned something else, and I forgot to touch on it, which is, you know, that the group that we are really most concerned about is the newborns and then young infants. And so one of the other ways of protecting them, in addition to everybody in the surroundings being careful and you know, hopefully being up to date, is the pregnant person also has the opportunity to get immunized with this vaccine, along with a couple others, to then transmit some of that immunity to protect babies against whooping cough. So moms are given the option and are encouraged to get a Tdap vaccine along with flu and RSV vaccines towards the end of pregnancy. That's really a way of giving the baby some immunity to get them started as they enter this big scary world of ours.
I was going to ask about that. That immunity then, when given Tdap to a pregnant person, that passes on to protect or help to protect an unborn baby. Would that be something done in each pregnancy?
Yeah, so they actually do suggest that they get a Tdap vaccine every pregnancy, and it really tides the kid over for the first, you know, 3 to 4 months of life. And the goal there is then when they get their first DTaP at 2 months of age, it gets them then started on making their own immunity. And then when they get their 4 and 6 month doses, then they're fully protected. So that dose during the end of pregnancy is pretty critical, because those really small infants, those neonates, are the ones that when they do get infected really, really do suffer. And those are the ones that, you know, in my long career of seeing infectious diseases, are they really the ones that break your heart, because all the kid can do is just cough and cough and cough and cough. They can't even stop to eat, let alone sleep. And it's a really miserable illness. And so, you know, part of our concern in seeing this spreading so widely, especially spreading in that adolescent group, is that many of them have contacts with those younger infants, whether as siblings or babysitters or whatever. And so we do really need to sort of pay attention to all the age groups who may expose our youngest and most vulnerable members of our communities.
And for adults and older adults, when should they get boosters?
Yeah, so, you know, we all are supposed to get a tetanus shot every 5 to 10 years. And one of the nice things has happened over the course of time is that we've been able to tie in a tetanus shot with having a little diphtheria and a little pertussis or whooping cough protection. So that's that Tdap vaccine. And, you know, while technically people could get just a straight tetanus shot, there's not a lot of companies making tetanus shots. And so for most people, we've pivoted and are offering them a Tdap as their booster for tetanus. So we do basically give people the option then of getting perpetual reminders for their immune system against pertussis. We certainly feel very strongly that, you know, everybody, especially in older age groups that are vulnerable to these respiratory illnesses. So all those folks over 65 should absolutely make sure that they've gotten one as well. But it really, since it's a disease that can affect all age groups, you know, really everybody now is eligible to get a Tdap in place of their regular tetanus shot and give them some of that pertussis protection.
Dr. Conway, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to do so, Kate. Thank you.
That was Dr. James Conway, a pediatrics professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, also serves as medical director for UW Health Immunization Programs. Now we look at possible explanations for the size of the current outbreak, and we bring in Dominique Brossard, who researches science and risk communication. Brossard is professor and chair in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison, also a principal investigator at the Morgridge Institute for Research. Dominique, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, Kate.
What are your thoughts on this spread of whooping cough cases?
Yes, thank you. And I think Dr. Conway put it very well. This is concerning. And certainly public health officials, science communicators, pediatricians alike are trying to find explanations for this. And I think it is clear that we've seen a decrease in vaccinations after COVID. And so we've been paying close attention to those numbers and trying to find explanations.
Wisconsin's childhood vaccination rates, they are lower than the national average. What might be going on there?
You know, each state is different as far as the type of exemptions they allow. So there's three types of exemptions. You can, not be required to get your kid vaccinated for medical reasons, right? For example, kids that are immunodepressed and so on and so forth. You can also have religious and personal convictions. That goes into the same pardon. You have also, however, something that's different across stage is the notion of personal belief, personal philosophy. And Wisconsin has, you know, allowed for quite a bit of time this type of exemption that you don't have in California, for example, where you have only medical exemptions. And we've seen a rise into those type of exemptions, like the personal conviction, personal belief exemption in Wisconsin have been on the rise. So this is concerning. So that means that something else is at play, and it's really the belief that will, make people choose not to vaccinate their kids.
In terms of that personal conviction point there, what effect might misinformation on social media, what effect could misleading content online have on what you're seeing play out with vaccines?
This is a great question. I'm so glad you asked it because, again, we don't want to actually, you know, reach simplistic conclusion. And it's really hard to say that because people see something online, they're going to change their behavior. People are hesitant for a wide range of reasons. And very often, misinformation that aligns with their belief may actually make them think they're going in the right direction. But it's not that suddenly it's going to completely change their way of thinking. So we are concerned when you have too much misinformation online that actually confirm what people think. We call that confirmation bias, and certainly this is a process at play. But there's a wide range of reasons why people may be hesitant. It may be, you know, a decrease in trust in institutions, and something we've seen after COVID, that Americans have been losing trust in a lot of institutions. So not only the scientific institution, medical institution, but schools institution, media institution, government institution. So a decline in institutional trust in general. The institutions that are supposed to keep our children and families safe. So this is concerning. That can be one reason. And also, you know, an increase in skepticism towards industry and big pharma. And so I could go on and on and on, but I think you were right in pointing out the potential of misinformation, but that's not the only things we should be, measuring and investigating.
So what steps can family physicians and pediatricians and the CDC do to really help to establish trust in vaccines.
Yeah, that's a good point. And again, you know, let's remember that, I mean, a close of 90% of the population is vaccinated. So like we do focus on the hesitant because we don't want that number to grow. We want to have obviously herd immunity in our populations. But however, we should also remember all of those that do get vaccinated and do it to keep, their community and their kids safe. So this being said, though, I think it's important to reestablish that trust by showing that safety is the primary concern and that when a vaccine is put into circulation or on the schedule of a child immunization record, it's done after a lot of steps. It's not just a one shot that Big Pharma wants to make money. As a matter of fact, they don't make much money with vaccines. So it's more complicated than that, and that all the steps are put into place to make sure that those vaccines not only are safe, but also are necessary, and that they are something that we need, to take into account to keep the American population safe.
How should the healthcare professionals bridge that conversation? How should they talk with their patients who might be skeptical of certain vaccines?
Yeah, and this is a great point. I mean, I was preparing for your show, I was trying to find a number specifically for different disease and hesitancy, and I didn't find really recent ones. However, a former student of mine that worked with Dr. Conway also, did for her thesis a examination of Wisconsinites, hesitancy towards different vaccines, and the pertussis one was actually one that people were a little wary of. So I think it's very important, number one, for healthcare providers to understand that not everyone reacts to all the vaccines the same way, which is something that we tend to think. It's not a one-size-fits-all. Like, some people would be comfortable giving 5 vaccines to their kids, but they're concerned about the numbers and, things like that, and what are the vaccines that generate more hesitancy. Number two, vaccine hesitancy has existed since vaccines have been put into circulation, early 20th century, big demonstration in Britain against vaccines and so on and so forth. So it's not a new thing. And a lot of doctors, I used to talk to their patients about this kind of thing. And, parents are concerned and they have the right to be concerned. And this is totally legitimate. And asking questions to your provider, to the person you trust, obviously your doctor, but also family members and so on, the church leaders, is also important to see and gather some information that will help you make the best decision for your family. At least at the end of the day, all of us that are working in the public health realm, what we want is for people's concerns to be addressed and be able to listen and respond in a genuine way with the best available science.
Dominique, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
That was Dominique Brossard, professor and chair in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison. Earlier, we heard from pediatrician Dr. Jim Conway about the spread of whooping cough cases in Wisconsin. They talked with Kate Archer-Kent earlier this week. If you are seeing an outbreak of pertussis, whooping cough in your community, your school, your family, tell us about it. Let us know what's going on in your neck of the woods. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.